This is Rafflebix After Hours.
Welcome back, everybody, to Rack Addicts After Hours. This is going to be episode 23, and we've got Pete and Telmo with us again today. Hopefully, we might actually have Andy back with us next week, so hopefully we'll have a listen to his lovely voice once again soon. I've not been up to much, to be honest, just digging into the Instro CSL complex oscillator. But what about you guys? Anything fun? Telmo's got a new addition behind him, but let's come back to you. Pete, what have you been doing?
I think 99.9% finished the hex mix, and ooh, I have to say,
testing left?
Yes, testing is imminent. I mean, I've left the tags, the support tags on the potentiometers unsoldered until I've tested the actual mixer itself. That's what they advise in the instructions. And I must say, you're absolutely right. It was literally hell getting all those all that control surface into the front panel. It was.
Yeah, you made it though.
Yeah, it was the.
You made it through.
Yeah, I mean, there's a trick to it once you get going and you realise, because I've taken it off a few times just to sort of adjust things. And then the other one, it was. How do you solder it? Well, there are ways, but soldering some of the components that are literally back to back on the boards. So you've got a component on one side, you've got a potentiometer on the other side, and then you have to turn it over and try and solder. And that was a challenge, say the least. Yeah.
It's a little bit of a nightmare. I had to do some sort of aerobics with my arms, elbows flying everywhere, trying to arrange it and all do all the jiggling.
Yes, so that's good. I will that will be completed this week anyway, just the testing and final cleanup. And I was going to ask, is the actual silk screening actually on a kind of sticker, or is there actually a protective layer of film on top of the? Because I saw that there is a sort of layer on the faceplate, but I didn't want to pick it off only to find it was actually what the printing was actually stuck to.
No, there's no protective layers of any kind as far as I'm aware.
Okay, so good job I didn't start picking away and found it was actual. So I think the way they've done it, they've got it's an aluminium faceplate with it looks like it's black anodized or maybe black enameled in some respect. But to get the white writing, it's a translucent sticker that sticks over the top rather than silk screening on top of the actual black enamel.
Yeah, I think that's how all the Bifaco stuff is done. I've got one sort of early kit of the second version of the in-amp. That's a PCB panel, but that's just because it's an early one.
So, and I did eventually receive an email from Omsonic, which I was...
Yes,
so nothing tangible other than they'll let me know as soon as they're in stock.
Oh, right.
Basically saying that they have component sourcing issues, but I suppose that's an easy one to throw out there. Hopefully they'll be able to resolve that as soon as possible, because I'm still desperate to get my hands on
it. Still itching for it. Telmo, your little friend behind you.
Yeah. Hello, everybody.
Oh, is it kind of a big friend?
It's a 12-inch friend. So this week, I'm actually feeling a bit mellow today. But last week, I decided to, as you guys know, I've mentioned a few episodes back that I was on the hunt for an amplifier, a guitar amplifier, and I came across in some of Fender's vintage amps. So they have like this whole directory of amps, and I was just looking for something that was versatile enough. And I thought about bass amps, so I went on a hunt of a guitar amp, so a bass amp that I could use for my guitar. And I found this particular model on Gumtree, which is the equivalent of Craigslist in America and all sorts of stuff. And there was this private seller, and he was selling, which now it's in my living room, a 1970s Music Master bass. This is a one-off amp that they did for about 10 years, from 1970 to about 1982, I think. So 12 years. They've never done it since. And as you guys can see in our little Zoom chat, it's got only two knobs, a tone and a volume, two instrument inputs, 12-inch ceramic speaker, 6V6 is tubes on the power amp section, and a 12EX7. It's a beautiful amp. It's genuinely the best amp I've ever owned. And this
kind of thing are we talking? Is it like just buckets and buckets of clean?
That's the thing. It's really nice and clean. We're only talking about 12 watts because this is a home slash practice amp, which is more than enough for me. But the major advantage is that it's really nice and crispy and clean and anything that you would expect from a Silverface Fender amp of the time. But it does break up. It does break up, and it gives you that nice overdrive. Once you reach about 8 to 9, it breaks up really nicely. And it doesn't matter if you plug in a bass, a guitar. I needed an amp that's versatile enough so that I can plug in a Rhodes or a piano or a synth or, you know, anything, or even a harmonica if I want, and will give me the enough low end that I need. And this is just a brilliant amp that I totally recommend just to anyone, just to go and check out if they
need.
How
hard is it to find, given that it's quite an old one?
It's really hard. This was the only UK plug version I could find on the internet. And it was literally 40 minutes away. The guy was super cool. He was a vintage collector as well. We ended up chatting about pedals and, you know, all sorts of gear that he has. He has an original RE-201. He's got a bunch of Moogs. He's got a Rhodes as well, a 1973 MK1. He was kind enough to bring it over to my place, obviously, just downstairs due to all the circumstances and keeping social distancing apart. He dropped the amp. I had a look. Very smooth transaction. Really cool guy. And I just can't stop playing it since.
Nice one. I have very limited knowledge of guitar amplifiers, really. The Bassman...
Yeah.
Was that one of those ones that was originally, okay, here, Fender's like, we're going to make a bass amp, and then people plugged guitars in and went, actually, it's amazing as a guitar amplifier?
Exactly.
Is it that kind of thing?
It's that kind of thing. The Bassman actually was originally from 65, I think. You've got the 60s blackface era from Fender, and then you have the 70s silverface. Obviously, that is due to the looks of it. So the Bassman has been a constant model, and this kind of follows that tradition of being a really good bass amp, but then you plug in a guitar and it sounds wow. It sounds like amazing. It's really good. So loads of guitar playing for me. Also, uni is done, so I finally finished it. University is out of my way.
Yeah, a little round of applause for Telmo.
Thank you, everybody. So, so that's done. And now I've got another 3 months just to do nothing.
Apply yourself rigorously to the writing and learning of music.
Oh, yes.
Of course.
Yeah, that's one of the things. But first, I will do nothing.
Sounds good. Well, speaking of writing music, an interesting method of, which doesn't really agree with some traditional musicians, is the sequencer. Mm-hmm. And Make Noise have released a new one, which is pretty cool. It's called the No Control, the Zero Control, the O Control. It is all of these or none of these. It is the same size as the No Coast, little desktop, West Coasty type thing. And when I first saw it, I was immediately hoping that they're going to release some kind of single panel No Coast, No Control, or maybe like a little wooden side paneled little with the angle, like a complete instrument of the two, because it's kind of like a lot of people were saying in the comments of the videos of these, that it's quite easily it's not going to be Buchla Music Easel clone, but because mm-hmm. of the its interesting weirdnesses that it has, it could potentially take you there. And I've spoken before about how I like self-contained instruments, but at the moment you have to have two separate power supplies, which I think is a bit clumsy, but it certainly looks cool. Would definitely recommend you watch Alex Theakston, Mylar Melodies video on it, because it's really, really good. Some big jams in there, and he explains it very well, as he always does.
Yes, I'd seen people refer to it as the sort of make noise easel.
Mm.
I don't think it'd be that hard for to get some nice sort of solid wood or some sort of something like, I don't know, a small piece of teak or a little bit of oak or something like that you could, you know, maybe recycle something for some discarded furniture or something like that.
I know you can mount the NoCoast just in regular Eurorack, but it does void your warranty. But somebody could probably DIY something pretty sweet.
Yeah, really? You have to kind of butcher it quite badly to do it.
Would you have to like file down the panel or something?
Yeah, I think because it's folded steel, so I think you have to sort of deflap it.
Oh, right.
I've kind of toyed with the thought of getting a NoCoast, but I was a bit cool on this initially. But it's once, as you say, watching the Mylar Melody video on it, and it was very concise, I suddenly got it. And I'm quite interested in the respect that the approach they've taken is to allow you to change all the parameters. And in that respect, I mean, when you have a conventional sequencer, it's very they can be very clockworky sounding.
Mm.
And obviously this is, I mean, you can sort of timing, but it's the way you can sort of adjust the individual timings of each stage. And you can tweak it, and it can do stuff that literally no other sequencer I've come across can actually do.
Yeah, that sort of freedom of timing and not having any quantized pitch really makes it quite interesting. And then obviously being able to spit that clock out to whatever else, other sequencers you have running, it's brilliant. And it's the little things like some of those gate outputs that also have an envelope output depending on how you patch it. It's really smart.
Yes, I mean, it still makes for quite an expensive lump if you buy a NoCoast or one of these together.
Once these, yeah.
I mean, I've put down $399 because the most tangible prices I saw was $399, which I always say it's going to be £399.
Yeah, so. that's where they're going in the makenoisemusic.com website.
Toman have got them advertised and suggest they'll be having them in about 3 to 4 weeks. I don't know how realistic that is, but...
who knows?
You know, I get the impression at this stage it may be easier to get products out of the US, assuming they've got the components to build them, than it is to get the get units out of China or the Far East at this current time.
Yeah, well, most make noise stuff is made in-house as long as they can source the components. Then I'm not sure if they do their own etching and printing of panels and PCBs and things, but the actual assembly, at the very least, is done in their building.
Well, didn't you visit them at roughly about the same time you went to visit Moog as well?
It was the same... was it the same day? It was the same day, because I was only in Asheville for a day. You can walk from one to the other, which is pretty cool. But yeah, seen there. They sort of have a very small bit at the front of their building with some of their systems on display and... some of the records of their artists. You can kind of shop a bit and play around there. And then just behind there, there's no walls or anything. That's just where they build things. It's pretty cool.
Because they're one of the sort of very early Eurorack manufacturers. They actually appear in Our Dream of Wires.
Mm.
Along with IntelliGel and several others that I can't recall at the moment.
That was a brilliant documentary, that was. That was really
nice. Have
you
seen it, Tomo?
Yeah, A Dream of Wires, a long time ago, about 2 years ago, I think, when it first came out on Netflix. Really do recommend anyone who is vaguely interested or just kind of never heard it. Well, in my case, at the time, I was like a little bit interested in synthesizers and the whole history with them, and that really it really spark a lot more interest from them.
It's really cool. Quite long, but we did have a ModCaf sort of watch party last summer, which was pretty fun. Just got some beers together.
Nice.
And just ploughed through. It's good fun.
Because there's two versions of it, the two edits. There's the long-form version of the film.
We did the long-form one.
Which, from what I can recall, it's in two parts. So you get the first part is mainly the history of synthesis from the... I think it's from the late 1940s onwards, and then you sort of jumps into the modern era, talking about modular manufacturers and features and various people. Including,
yeah, I think they talk about Stockhausen and you know the East Coast, and then they go to America and the West Coast, and you know Moog and what they were doing and that sort of stuff. It's quite interesting.
So going back to sequencers, I mean there is quite a vast selection that is now available, either in Eurorack format or even freestanding. I mean, what do you guys particularly have any particular preferences or sort of pre-existing sequences that you do you have any favourites or ones that you desire, wish you can afford? Because some of them are quite expensive, to say the least.
They can be, yeah. Most of the ones that I gravitate towards are the weirder ones, or ones that would be quite surprising or difficult to use or obtruse in some way, just because I'm rubbish at writing music in a normal fashion anyway. So the Turing machine has been a favourite for ages. The Klee sequencer, or I don't know if it's supposed to be pronounced Clay, which is K-L-E-E, those kind of things. Actually, to be honest, just a really simple one, Pressure Points, is really, really nice, because it's just simple four steps and, you know, unquantized voltages in three rows, but giving it that physical interface for your modular system. I do quite like those.
Well, this new O Control has a certain sort of Pressure Points vibe about it, with the sort of little capacitive touch sort of
pads.
Yeah,
it could definitely replace the double Pressure Points and Brains combo, and also add loads more.
I think the thing with sequencers is that it really depends what you're going to use them for. You know, if I could. If I was really into that, and if I had all the time in the world, I would buy an Octotrack, and I would just, you know, spend all the time by doing something like that.
Do the rabbit hole.
Exactly. But then, you know, it depends which sort of DAW you use. If you're using Ableton, the Push 2 is really nice. I mean, I've seen guys playing literally, not only using the sequencers, but actually playing like really nice chords, and the way that the blocks are built and the software is works really well with that. I mean, just even a Korg SQ2 will do the job. I mean, if you're looking for something a bit cheaper.
Well, it's an SQ1.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there he is. Can't see it, but yeah.
I got this SQ1, and that was sort of thrown in when I bought the MS-20 desktop version, the full-size desktop limited edition that came out a few years ago, which is that one behind me at the top.
Right.
It's one of these ones I don't use enough. I mean, I had thought about wondering if this could be adapted to Eurorack. Some, you know, potentially, I thought that might be a thing, but I wasn't quite sure how I could power it. Or it's got USB, so I assume it's 5 volts.
Mm. It also has if you mod a battery into it.
Well, it's got a battery. Really, it's got a battery compartment at the back.
Oh, there's batteries anyway. Oh yeah.
Okay, oh, there
so
we go.
If you just have really long CV and gate cables, you can kind of stand up, sort of just hold that in your hands and just feed it into your modular and just kind of wander around with it. That'd be nice. Quite cool. Now, something that I've always thought might be kind of interesting with the Division 6 business card sequencer. So this one, it's literally business card sized, and you can power it from a 5-volt kind of source from your modular. And then it'll just have CV and gate. So it's really tiny, but you can just sort of have this little credit card sized thing and just control your modular with it.
That's amazing.
And they're really cheap as well, and so you can DIY them. I should do that.
Are they the pocket operators of modulars?
Yeah, they're those kind of clicky buttons and things, but they have a proper little case, so they don't have bare PCB.
Yeah,
I've been craving some more DIY, so I might have to order one.
Ooh,
at some point.
I like this.
And of course, Pete, if you do want to make a micro plats, I'm definitely on board, because I need a challenge.
Yes, so well, I'm looking at a lot of those sort of commons, Creative Commons type of open source sort of projects. I noticed with Thonk that I think they've got a few of the things like Turing Machine, but mostly they're just components at this time.
Yeah,
so
they've got Turing Machine, the Mutable CV PAL, and the God's Box Humpback filter.
Yeah, the filter.
That's it right now.
So I think I need to look at other retailers that sell kits and so forth. So I don't know quite why Thonk has gone into that kind of I know the sort of motivation because of the current lockdown, but I don't know what the issue is in respect to not selling kits. Or maybe they,
I think it's for their, because most of their business, their staff are just going to be, it's just picking, a lot of picking.
Yeah, I can imagine.
I imagine they're trying to limit the amount of people that are in whatever room they keep their parts in. All that kind of stuff.
So it's a physicality type of issue.
I think so, yeah. They're just trying to just keep everybody as far apart as possible.
Because I know prior to all this, they were actually hiring. So obviously the business is growing.
And I was going to apply, but I never, never did.
Well, where are they, Danny? Are they close to
Brighton?
Yeah, so
yeah, I think in Brighton.
Fair enough. Would you commute if you?
Well, I was thinking commute if I did a couple of days, and then I kind of wanted to move there anyway for a while. So,
yeah,
yeah, it's quite cool.
Brighton is really cool. I like it.
So another popular one, especially with all sorts of musicians, but you see it a lot in the modular world, is obviously the BeatStep Pro.
Oh, of course, yeah,
classic.
Which is again,
you got the black one.
Yes, again, it's one of the more traditional step sequencer type of affairs. I mean, there is a whole range of others that I can think of, like the Stepper Acid, which is very sort of reminiscent of the sort of 303. Then there's the one that Audio Damage do, which I can't quite remember what they call it at the moment.
I don't think they call it anything at the moment, because Audio Damage aren't producing any modules, are they?
Well, I saw one recently. I forgot. Oh, yeah. Didn't they have... well, they definitely stopped for a time, but have they stopped completely then?
Well, I haven't seen anything from them recently.
Because no,
they
what
do
you
plugins
mean.
As well, don't they? I think they were just sticking to that.
Just what? And how recent are we talking in that respect?
A year ago, maybe?
Yeah, now you say it, I did sort of seem to remember something about the ceasing of production. I mean, this is maybe one that I just saw selling for second hand, because I was looking at one relatively recently. And then there's the Harvestman, there's the Stilson's Hammer.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's like that's the one that's sort of four Metropolises in a box, isn't it?
Yeah, I know someone who got one, and I think he got rid of it in swift order, not because it wasn't good, it was just so complicated.
Hmm.
I've never got my hands on it. And again, it's another one of these that's, I think it's close to, I want to say it's close to £600. I could be wrong, but it's a
pricey one. Did we mention that other Metropolis-like sequencer last week?
We spoke about the Metropolis in a certain context, I think. I mean, I certainly mentioned it in the respect we were talking about Colin Bender having four of them.
Mm. Yeah, we had an array of Metropolis based. Yeah.
Good. Well, there's that DIY one. It's £250, so I've got my eyes on one of those when the kit's available again.
And is that a Thonk thing or someone else?
No, but the manufacturer ships kits from sort of directly.
And are they out of stock at the moment? Are they?
Yes, I think they. I looked once; they were in stock, and then sort of half an hour later, and they've all gone.
Yeah, I mean, that's the trouble, especially when they're making or producing limited batches, even if they're just kits. You know, they're just, it's amazing how much global demand there is for this sort of thing. Now, I think it feeds into what you were saying the other week, that how you like the modular scene to be sort of a bit underground, a bit exclusive.
Yeah.
And in reality, even though it still has that sort of character to it, it really is. There's so many people in it. If you add up the aggregate of everyone around the world that's
absolutely
into modular now, it makes up quite a big cohort, really.
Mm-hmm. What I see as well developing a lot, for especially for performers, in order to bring their performances live, because there's going to be a lot more competition, especially once all of this goes back to normal, is the use of MIDI controllers. There are unusual MIDI controllers like Gloves, or like, I think it's Uriah Heep that uses one. That's an example of how you can control with your performance the musicality of it. But this is just, just a little aside. Of course, synths are always there, man, always there.
Yeah, played a show a while ago supporting Void Null, a local AV act, and Lucas Paris AV had a set afterwards as well, which is, I think, most of the sound generation sequencing was done on two iPads. So he's using the accelerometers in those to kind of change his lighting and the sounds and things.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah,
I'm
there's
sorry,
definitely
it's
lots of interesting controllers about.
It's actually not Uriah Heep. That's a 1970s hard rock
Imogen
band. Imogen Heap, that's the one. check on the tune Hide and Seek's really good.
Well, going on from that, I did receive an email last week from, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, it's the Blokas team, and Blokas is spelled B-L-O-K-A-S. Mm-hmm. And they're the group of fabricators that I pre-funded, and I come searching for the right terminology.
Well, like
for
Kickstarter or something?
Yeah, yes, basically. It was a Kickstarter project. For their MIDI hub, so they've informed me that the units will be shipping, so I should be getting an email. So that is nice. A tiny little I mean, you literally fit it into the palm of your hand. So it's a tiny MIDI hub, but essentially it's got
mini jacks.
It's basically got a built-in sequencer. I think I mentioned this the other week in the podcast.
Interesting.
And so I'll be quite interested to see that. There's also an accompanying software package which you can download for free for all various platforms. So I think it's even for certainly for Mac and Windows, but I think there might even be a Linux version as well. And that allows you to do it's almost a piano roll type sequence that you can load into it. But once it's actually loaded, that's it really. So I don't know quite how you actually trigger the sequence. That would be the interesting, how you work it once, whether it just starts automatically when you plug it in.
It just keeps going forever.
Whether there's a little, because the picture, there doesn't seem to be, there's some indicator lights. And there's a little switch, so maybe the switch triggers it. So I don't know what the scope is, how much, whether you could fit a whole performance or just one track in there, but that could be quite interesting. Again, certainly for the sort of fixed melodious sort of parts, if you wanted something where you want sort of quite a decent bit of melodic structure to fit around maybe some improvised modular stuff around it.
Hmm.
So
that'd be cool.
That'd be quite interesting. And then, of course, the love of my life, it is at the moment, it's where because I haven't actually got my hands on it. The one we talked about, I believe, 2 weeks ago, as I said, they spoke to me. The Omtonic. I can never pronounce this properly. Again,
they do stochastic somethings.
Stochastic inspiration generator.
Ah, there we go. Oh,
that's a catchy name, isn't it?
I mean. it's still nowhere near as the as bad as the some manufacturers. Like noise engineering, like so called.
Oh, yeah.
There, sort of,
it's like, we're going to call everything a Latin name just to be annoying.
Just something that you cannot pronounce very easily.
Oh, well, we love them, really.
And invariably, yeah, they're wonderful modules, but I just struggle pronouncing. I have considered buying one of the classic oscillators, which I'm not going to even bother.
Oh, what, one of the kind of the like percussive ones?
No, one of the sort of, did they describe as comb oscillators? I think it's a.
Oh, is that? It might be Ataraxic Ateritas, that one.
Yeah, one of the early ones. And then they did an expanded
version. Or Laquelic Ateritas.
Yes, that's it.
And then the big one, which has that giant knob in the middle called the Master Blaster. Roots the envelope to loads of places or something. It's pretty fun.
They seem to be coming up at sort of semi reasonable prices in sort of in the used market. So it's one of those that I've been considering for quite a long time.
One of my favourites, the one that I sold and bought back and will never let out of my sight again, Manus Ateritas, sitting next to me with the controls for Smash, Bash and Profundity.
Oh, that just makes fantastic. The whole thing.
And what sort of tonal palette does that produce?
Oh, it really does smash and it will also bash.
Okay.
Does it Master Blaster, though?
It doesn't have a Master Blaster. No. it's actually a six-operator sawtooth FM thing. And it's noisy and mean and growly.
Growly and dirty and bad and horrible.
Yeah, in all the best ways. But it can be quite a polite, just filtered sawtooth if you want it to be as well.
So saucy. Is there any other modules that you have either had and got rid of, regret getting rid of and got back?
Yeah.
Or
actually, sequencers. A really little one, which I'm hoping will turn up on Thonk again, the RYO Penta sequencer, which is quite music easel-ish. It's just a five-step analog potentiometer. You've got a clock, a reset, and an output, and just five steps, and then you can switch it between three, four, and five steps long, so you can get some interesting little interplays sometimes. I used to have two of those, and I sold both of them because I'm an idiot. But they're cheap. I'll just DIY two more. Really
yeah, that's
nice.
Always the joy with DIY kits. I mean, I had. I keep having these sort of, oh, should I buy a clutch of kits? And I've done this in the past, make them up and sort of sell them. But there's very little margin. Obviously, you get the pleasure of building the kits. And it's gone relatively well with most customers. But you get the odd one that just sort of complains about something like the noise floor not being.
Yeah.
I mean, even if it's inherently in the design of the module. I'm not sure how unless you can buy these things in bulk, how much it's really worth doing, but it's always an interesting exercise to think about.
No, if you're kind of confident in your skills and you can do it properly, then it just means if you do sell it, you make a tiny bit of money instead of losing it.
Start a production line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Well, leading away from that entirely, sort of rambling talk about sequences and other modules. Unfortunately, last week and into the weekend was not great for losing sort of notable musicians. And over the last couple of weeks, we've mentioned the odd one as they've unfortunately passed away. But last week, it seemed to be there was a sort of a cascade. I haven't listed them all here in the show notes, but I thought we would sort of potentially mention or discuss some of the ones that particularly stuck out in my mind as being relevant in their own field or their own genre. I mean, the top of the list, obviously, relatively recently, was the passing of Little Richard. And that was one of the ones that I would imagine made international news globally and would have been most recognised by...
Yeah, by the media and
by the media
because
and
of his
so
popularity.
Forth.
Yeah,
I mean, as someone who claims to have invented rock and roll, he's definitely not shied away from the spotlight.
Yes, I mean, he continuously performing relatively up to quite recently and quite a character and
Absolutely.
Certainly fundamental to the early days of rock and roll, along with several other acts and artists. So I think it's relevant that we acknowledge his passing. But the two that I wanted to come on to would be Florian Schneider from Kraftwerk, and then secondly, Dave Greenfield from The Stranglers. Certainly with Florian and Kraftwerk in itself, I don't think that we can deny their influence on the synthesizer scene, the electro-pop scene, even if you weren't particularly into them. I mean, I can't say that I was certainly obviously very aware of Kraftwerk, but it wasn't a band that I particularly followed, or I never got to see them live or anything like that. But I have to acknowledge their influence on certainly on artists that I did enjoy and follow more closely.
Mm-hmm.
How
Absolutely.
About you guys?
Especially David Bowie, isn't it? Because he did this whole Berlin trilogy with sounds that were heavily influenced by Kraftwerk's. I don't know a lot about Florian Schneider himself, but you cannot deny the influence on synth pop and European music in the late 70s.
Yes, I mean, they were doing the sort of... I mean, obviously it had a very Germanic sound to it, but, you know, it wasn't really replicated until the sort of 80s when you had sort of the new romantic type thing. And again, that they would have been heavily influenced by Kraftwerk. I don't know how much work or whether they were doing anything in the recent years.
I think they had a couple of other acts, associated acts apart from Kraftwerk. So Florian Schneider was also doing stuff with Organization and Piss Off. But but yeah, that's what it's called.
But yes, I've noticed the certainly it looks like he definitely influenced and worked with a real number of instruments. And also the use of particular techniques.
It's one of those things that often happens with these early influential artists. You can't really fully grasp the amount of sort of people and music they've touched until you have your theoretical time machine and go and just erase them from the past and then seeing kind of what would happen.
What,
you know?
Sort of a chasm or hole opens up.
Yeah. Just how much music would be lost.
Yeah.
Again, I mean, because again, I was aware of them in the late 70s and so forth. And at that stage, you don't. It's pretty much what you're saying, Ben. You don't realise the long-term impact or the influence they're going to exert on the sort of music scene and moving into the future.
Yeah, absolutely.
So apart from Little Richard, who we mentioned earlier, who was substantially, he was almost the previous generation of musicians, but Florian and Dave Greenfield, who I want to go on to talk about in the context of The Stranglers, were pretty much the same age or in the same demographic. So The Stranglers were very indicative of a certain time of my life. As I was saying to you guys earlier, they sort of rode in on the punk bandwagon, so to speak, but they weren't really punk, and they had existed slightly prior to punk, but they did have that kind of aggressive edginess. But they also had something that a lot of punk bands weren't. They had keyboards, involved, whereas punks tend to be, it was tend to be just guitar and bass and so forth and vocals.
Sure. Yeah.
The keyboard element almost harks back to something like the Doors in some respects. That's the sort of analogy from the previous generation.
Yeah.
But you know, the Stranglers did a couple of very significant albums in the late 70s, and they were very well constructed. I mean, the songs are very, very well written and very memorable. And maybe it's me being a bit of an old sort of fuddy-duddy in that respect, talking about, you know, there's the usual adages, all the music used to be better back in the day. But there is something to be said about the certain eras. And again, this is something I might have sort of reiterated on the... Or I'm reiterating that I might have said on the podcast before, is that although modern music is so highly produced, very professionally produced and very professionally performed, in a lot of cases, they don't have very striking hooks or melodies as did the sort of music in the 70s and the 80s did.
Yeah, you go ahead. I think that the reason for that, Pete, is because we kind of changed the way that we see melody. We don't see melody as we used to. We use more... a rhythmic sense to, like, imagine, look at Billie Eilish and look at her incredibly catchy songs. Yes, but it's a different kind of catchiness. It's not melody-wise, it's rhythmic-wise. Do you see what I'm trying to...
Yeah, I mean, there's that certain... I can't remember exactly which... is it Bury a Friend or another track where she has that trap beat, which they use quite a lot.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
It's
yeah.
very. You just have to hear the beat, and it's got and the bass line that goes with it, and it's very distinctive.
Yeah.
And then there's the is it Tough Guy? I'm trying to sound hip.
I know the Bad Guy.
Bad guy. Someone. There we go. I'm that's trying to sound hip and actually think I sound like I actually know what I'm talking about.
He's a tough guy, isn't it?
Yeah, that's. I knew it was something like that. But that's got it's got a hook in it, and it's quite. It's almost annoying.
Yeah,
it's got a childlike quality to it, but it's even been used in a British Telecom advert.
Is it actually? Oh, amazing.
You know, because it's so notable. But I mean, what I meant about the sort of songs from the 70s and 80s, they're still being played now.
Yeah, they're timeless.
And they are timeless, and they've got very strong melodies. Did we have a discussion about, or was it myself? I was having a discussion about ABBA with my daughter because she was watching Mamma Mia. Two or whatever it's called.
What a great afternoon.
You weren't in the room at the time.
Yeah.
Oh no.
Let's Bjorn and Benny, let's make some more money.
Yeah.
Let's play the more obscure ABBA songs. We milked the first lot. But I have to say, as I say, I was very sort of disinterested in ABBA at the time. I mean, I was looking back. Again, they won the European Song Contest in 1974, and then they went on to have a phenomenal career for, I don't know, a good, I don't know, 7 to 10 years after that. And at the time, it was just sort of pop. But looking back and understanding more about songwriting and music production, you realise how fantastically well those songs are written and how well they're constructed and how well they work. And again... Sure. How, in some respects, how timeless they are. You know, the fact that you can have a series of songs that you perform and publish as a pop band, and then later you can convert those songs into a long-running musical, and then subsequently after that you can convert it into a feature film of the musical.
Yeah.
And
I think they were just the pinnacle of what funk music brought or disco music brought to just pop and the world in general, I think, because I kind of like see ABBA from and not the band itself, but I like to look at it from a higher perspective and seeing historically what made ABBA what they are is you know, funk and disco that really put them and made them so successful in the early 70s late 70s and early 80s.
But you see the same situation with Queen, you know, a performing, publishing, record producing band that is subsequently later it's turned into a stage show,
yeah.
And then subsequently it's turned into a film, and I can imagine them doing a film of the stage show as well.
Yeah,
and a similar thing with Elton John. It's the same thing. It's, you know, it just transitions, and they songs and the production and the whole. Everything about it is so well structured that they can get 40 plus years of, you know, revenue out of it. Whereas I just don't see I don't know, pull an artist out of my head. I don't see, I can't envisage the Post Malone musical somehow.
That is a very good point, Pete. That is a very good point indeed.
You never know. Maybe when Post Malone is, counts as retro.
Yeah.
Maybe it'll happen.
I mean, maybe it's me. Maybe, it's, as I say, I don't know. It just seems to be that it's something missing from, not all, but quite a lot of modern music. It's just, it's, as I said earlier, it's very highly produced. It's very professional. They're very competent at doing it. But there's just a distinct lack of, I can't put my finger on it.
Pete, is the way that we consume music these days, because there's so much more music out there, and I think that Ben will share with me as being slightly younger and being from a slightly different generation. I think that right now, to really find good music, you really need to work hard. Because back in the day, I mean, you turn on the radio and, you know, you would hear Queen and you know, these fantastic bands and all of the ones that you're describing, and including the Stranglers. But these days,
you turn on the radio and then you immediately turn it off again.
Exactly. So you really need, or you need to find a radio station online that will play the music that you want, or just for you to find different things. So it's a different kind of world out there.
But yes, there's still good music. The structure of music's changed because the way people consume music. You don't have massive lead-ins now. They go straight into the music. If there's a sort of a very gradual lead-in, people tend to switch off. I mean, there's that sort of, you know, the shortest attention span that the sort of we all suffer from these days in respect to how we consume media. But I mean, the other case in point is if these pieces of music from all these previous genres are so significant, they you keep finding them being resampled and reused by certain artists. So that just shows, what they're having to do. Some rap artist produce something that has a particularly interesting hook in it, you invariably find it's been sampled from one of these things from the period I'm talking about. And lo and behold, he's got sort of recording magic. He's got something that's got a really interesting hook in it. And, immediately...
you find out it was from the past.
I think, it's important that... For the right reasons, I'm saying this, because sometimes, the Baby Shark song or whatever it is.
Oh man,
yeah, that's the bad side of earworm.
Yeah.
But it's got to be memorable. It's got to pull you in. It's got to be catchy.
And Golden Brown certainly is, and thanks to Dave Greenfield.
Yeah, that's particularly
massive tune.
That harpsichord sequence, and again, I just remember it. I think it was 81. I'd like to say that was out. I'm sure it was 81. Yes, and it was just a memorable time. It was just a big hit during the whole summer.
Yeah,
I mean, it was just.
And who would have
away,
said?
Yeah, certainly.
The,
who would
the
have
harpsichord
said,
would come back into fashion, you know.
But it was so again. It was so different to everything else. It's one of these tracks that just comes out of left field like that, and it just. I think it was certainly rode high, very high in the charts. If not, was a number one. And in those days, number ones tended to stay number one for quite a significant amount of time. I don't know what the average. Time for a piece of music in any of the particular charts, and nowadays there's so many different charts as well, so
there we go.
As you say, it's just the general ubiquity of music. There's so much and so much choice.
So true.
It's something that we always end up talking about. It's how music today isn't the same.
I know.
One day we'll come back around. I'm pretty sure it will.
I know. It sounds like it's me just doing the old fuddy duddy sort of bit or music. I mean, it's not to say I haven't heard good pieces of audio. And I mean, I heard something very significant the other day that just made the hairs on the back of my arms go up and give you that whole body feeling, which is what I really want to get from music. Something that really does. Grabs me emotionally, or I get an emotional physical response from. But ironically, it was just a piece of backing music on a news article. And I tried to use Shazam to find out whether it was something that they'd actually just lifted somebody's piece of music, or was it something from the BBC sound department.
It's about time that we give you some media to dig into when you've got free time to twiddle your thumbs. Telmo, you'll probably be able to help me in terms of categorising my recommendation, but I'm going to recommend you a piano player / composer. The YouTube channel is IBI, which is just IBI, the letters IBI. And this person plays the piano in what is, I think, well, in terms of the recording anyway, it's kind of a modern trend that we're seeing, where you'll have someone with a nice upright piano, they'll take the front off to expose the hammers and things, and they'll record like really close up. Occasionally they'll have felt behind the hammers, between the strings, and they'll use some pretty brutal compression on it, which gives it this really, really intimate feeling where you can hear lots of the background noise. So it sounds like they're playing really quietly and like really gentle, because you can hear so much of the room. There's a little bit of that going on. It's not as extreme as I've heard, but there's some of Ibby's compositions, as well as covers of there's some Einaudi, Hans Zimmer bits in here. But they're just really nice, thoughtful, and often quite relaxing pieces, and they're just a joy to listen to and watch, because I do enjoy seeing the mechanism of a piano with some expert hands. But in terms of style, Telmo would be potentially able to categorize it. I've got no idea. It's just nice piano. So Ibby on YouTube.
I'm gonna have to listen to it properly. Yeah. It seems like it's that sort of like new age piano, where you see, you know, atmospherical meets classical meets jazz kind of thing, which is really cool. I dig it. As to the piano itself, it's not the first time I've seen this. Not only is very aesthetically pleasing to watch, as you said, but it also gives it a different resonance. It's not as muddy. It kind of opens the sound a bit when you
can hear all the kind of friction between the various bits of the keys, especially when they compress it like they do.
It's really cool.
It's quite nice.
Nice.
Who's next? Who's my next victim? What are you going to recommend? Telmo.
Well, I'm going to be honest. I didn't really find anything in particular that would be extremely, kind of cool or whatever. There's loads of musicians that I could show. And if you're a guitar player, I'm going to just give you a really cool channel to look at. He's one of the hottest, guitar players out there right now, and he's got a very particular style. His YouTube channel is Matteo Mancuso. He's Italian, so it's Matteo, and then Mancuso. He's a very interesting jazz, fusion, classical player. That's got a very particular picking technique with his finger. So he plays as a flamenco player, this extremely fast sweeping runs, which is very, very different. I was absolutely astonished when I found this out. So, I would definitely, if just into any sorts of music, if you're into, like I said, he does like a lot of like old school jazz, but he does also some Tom Misch, which is nice and soul-y. So it's worth having a look. Also, this is not a YouTube recommendation, but it's something that I would like to mention anyway, which is something, it's been on my window all day. Mm. It's the ISM, Institute, sorry, hang on. It's the Incorporated Society of Musicians. So I've been thinking about joining the ISM, and I've been recommended by my university to do it. Basically, it's the UK's professional body for musicians and subject association for music. So if you're a musician out there, this is specifically for the United Kingdom. I'm pretty sure that if you're, you know, in America, they have a similar thing. If you're in France, they have a similar thing, you know, probably even an European one. But it's for the strange times that we're living today. This is very, very helpful, because not only you can join if you're a student, you can get obviously some sort of discount. But if you're a working professional musician, by buying a membership, you can get all sorts of benefits. And this is what talking about legal support, which is a 24-hour legal helpline. That's very helpful depending on whatever you're getting into. You get all sorts of protection, all sorts of insurance that is available for your gear, for you as a musician. You get professional development and unique expertise. So, you know, even help with Brexit and copyright and performers' rights. How does it work once you, you know, if you have a gig in Europe and you don't know how you're going to proceed, this is going to give you a really customized help. As well as with well-being services, and there's a whole community, and it really helps you as a musician to stand up for your rights. And I think it's really important for us to, you know, join these organizations and you know, thrive.
So support each other through them as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, that's my recommendations for the week. How about you, Pete?
Right, as usual, I always throw in the non-musical recommendation. So this week, from my copious and expansive subscription list on YouTube, I wanted to recommend a channel called Explaining Computers. And this particular gentleman has been running this channel for quite a number of years, and he generally puts up a video a week. And he'll go into excruciating or infinite detail on a particular product or particular item. The whole channel's got this kind of, although it's obviously done on modern equipment, it's got this weird feel of like I don't know if you guys would have ever seen clips of very early 80s computer programs on the BBC.
What did you say it was called? Explaining Computers?
Computers, or one word. And it's got even it's almost got a kind of, almost like a chiptune sort of theme tune, so to speak, and the gentleman is he comes across a bit weird I don't want to be offensive in a good way, but he's very succinct and very you know, he explains things. So a lot of the times he's sort of looking into.
I totally know what you mean.
Yeah,
yeah, he does look a bit.
So, but he's off quite often talking about small microcomputers like Raspberry Pis.
Oh, nice.
And so forth. And he'll go into various into detail about, and he'll do a little unboxing, and then he'll fire them up and he'll load an operating system on it. And then he'll do one on just SD cards and all the different varieties. But he'll quickly, you know, if you really want to find out, you know, about a particular thing like a solid state drive and the different differences in speeds, and quickly understand the different protocols. And you know, if you were thinking that you wanted to purchase one of these, or you're in the market for something that you wanted to sort of find out about it quickly, it's a very good way of quickly gaining that knowledge, and you know, allowing you to make a decision on the hurry up, so to speak. I mean, some of the stuff is a bit more obscure, and he has got a slight strange delivery, you know, just the way he constructs the videos and how he performs on the videos. It's very unique, let's put it that way. But yeah, I just thought I'd throw that one in.
No, it looks like there's some good stuff to dig into there. I was, like I said, I think last week, because I really enjoy the lock-picking lawyer, though I don't care at all about picking locks, I feel like this guy's going to have the same kind of vibe, where he just has this huge sort of depth of knowledge and he's just kind of sharing that with people.
Yeah, he certainly knows absolutely what he's talking about. It, and they're not too elaborate, the videos. He doesn't spend they're not very long videos. They're all about 10, 15 minutes, I'm looking at max, if not shorter. So he doesn't sit there trying to, I mean, you know, there's quite a few people that publish on YouTube, and they seem to be, the goal seems to be, is to sort of spin out or drag out the video as long as possible. I don't know if they're trying to game the system or sort of get more sort of advertising slots or what they're trying to achieve. But yeah, he seems to cut to the quick quite quickly, and you know, they go at a reasonable pace, and they, as I say, there is quite a reasonable amount of entertainment value on top of the informative side of it.
It's very interesting, the fact that he not only talks about hardware but also loads of software. Can see Affinity Photo, a real Photoshop alternative.
Yeah, there's all sorts of different products. He'll go into a lot of the Linux varieties. He'll talk about a lot of the more obscure operating systems that you load into these microcomputers. And of course, yeah. To a degree where they cross over, these microcomputers are used quite a lot in modular.
Yeah, the Arduino kind of offshoots, the Teensies. Yes. That's the beating heart of the Manus Aeteritas. It's just a Teensy.
And do you know of anyone that's actually used a Raspberry Pi in any kind of
I have a feeling one of the Bens from the ModCaf might have done. He seems like the kind of guy.
But there's no one's produced anything.
I know of a video synthesizer that has got a Raspberry Pi.
Oh,
yeah. I need to find a name. Sorry for interrupting you.
That's all right. Is that open source? I mean, is it something that you can get? Because I've over the years, I've bought, because they're so inexpensive, I thought, I'll just buy one while I'm getting some components, because they're generally, they sell them on Farnell and CPC. Mm. And you thought, I'll just pop one of those in my basket on my way through. And I generally get them and get a little case for them and then sort of load them up and do nothing more with them. So I've ended up with a few of them. And I really should pull my finger out and actually utilize the things. I'm just sort of fascinated.
One of the guys from the video place has built us a little kind of screen that based on a Raspberry Pi that will just sort of scroll through a little bit of news and show kind of our active project status and all that kind of stuff, which is quite nice.
Yes, I really should spend. It's another one of these things where I'm always remonstrating myself, saying I really must, and then I never do. So eventually, one day, I shall get round to actually doing something constructive or creative with these little Raspberry Pi collection I built up.
Yeah,
which means you can dig into them at any point.
Yes.
Just to mention quickly before we finish, what I was just talking about, this video synthesizer by Critter and Guitari. It's called the Izen.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys ever had a look, it's basically a Raspberry Pi with a bunch of knobs that transform your music into video, and this video can be can change depending on the frequencies that are arriving or you're controlling with the synth. It's currently, I think it's still on Kickstarter, but you can pre-order. And
it's been been kind of in the works for quite a while. They'd been sort of teasing it for ages.
It looks really cool.
Is the Kickstarter just for the software, or are they selling the whole package?
No, they're selling the whole thing, the actual synth itself.
And it's Chris and Guitari, so they'll have the lovely little wooden buttons and things.
Yeah, they do have the interesting packaging for their other pieces, bits and pieces. I mean, what does it put it out in, HDMI or something like that?
Yeah, HDMI out, and basically it even has a MIDI controller which you can assign certain, let's say, part of the image or you know, a bubble that you want to create visually. You can assign it to a certain parameter, like a filter of, you know, whatever wave you're sending through, or to a beat. So it kind of like, I really need to dig in this to do a bit more research, see how they make the synth itself.
Is the Kickstarter still open and running, or is it completed?
Yeah. There's a slight description about coding, about how you can get screen grabs and stuff like that.
Do they have an ETA when they're going to have these available, or is it one of these things?
June 2020.
Okay, I might have a look at that. I'm always interested in that sort of thing. What's the minimum spend to actually get one of these units through the Kickstarter?
To get one unit, you have to pledge $295, and that includes an IZ video synthesizer, power adapter, and a USB Wi-Fi adapter as well. And it ships to anywhere in the world. If you've got a bit more money, you can buy two for $590.
Not too bad. It's a lot more accessible than the LZX Vidiot, which is always annoyingly expensive.
Yeah.
Anyway, I hope you dig into our little recommendations for you there and you enjoy them. And tune in next time to episode 24. It'll be yet more Rack Addicts After Hours. Thanks for listening. Bye.